President Trump is making a hard sell for $5.7 billion in border wall spending. Meanwhile, the partial government shutdown is in its third week, tying the record for the second longest ever. The president is taking his case to the American people tonight in a primetime address that we will carry live beginning at 8 o'clock on the Ideas Network. The president visits the border on Thursday, and we're looking at the ripple effect of the government shutdown here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta and a political analyst. She teaches courses on African-American politics, political participation, and race and elections. Andra, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
So about 800,000 federal workers are set to miss their first paycheck on Friday. What jobs do these hundreds of thousands of people have? Help us paint a portrait here.
So the types of jobs that are affected by the shutdown are jobs that would be considered non-essential. So these would be jobs that aren't necessarily directly sort of connected to national security. So, of course, we're looking at the civilian employees, not people who are associated with the military. And when we think about the types of people who are working, we are looking at folks who would actually sort of be vital to sort of making sure that things run. So, for instance, TSA workers would be considered essential because they have a national security function or they have a really sort of, you know, top-level exigency in terms of the jobs that they do. But the person who, you know, might be processing your small business loan might not actually sort of be considered sort of as necessary or as vital.
So it's one thing to know you're not going to get paid. It's another to see the balance in your bank account go lower and lower. Should we expect people to stop coming to work if they're not being paid on time or being paid at all?
Well, I mean, so, you know, there have been reports about this, particularly with TSA, that there have been people who have been doing sick outs. Sometimes, you know, we don't know how much of this is related to protest or how much of this is actually just related to the economic reality of the job. So if people aren't getting paid, then they might not even have the money to be able to afford to get to work. They might not be able to afford gas. They might not be able to afford the fare on public transportation in order to get themselves to work. You know, I think, you know, part of the motivation behind telling essential employees that they have to report is that the mission is more important necessarily than whether or not they're getting paid. Now, one of the things that has typically happened in shutdowns is that when the shutdown is over, usually Congress retroactively reimburses employees for the time off. So if they're salaried, they'll get their salary back. And, you know, if they were working without pay, then they will end up getting paid. You know, that doesn't necessarily happen immediately always. And I think it's also really important to understand that if somebody is working for the federal government, but they're working as a contract employee, then, you know, it's a question of whether or not those folks get paid, and those folks are not necessarily paid as well because they're not being directly paid by the U.S. Treasury.
Well, we know unemployment is low. We're seeing some really robust job growth under this administration, and companies are looking for workers. Could government employees who aren't being paid right now go and find jobs in the private sector, and may we start seeing this trend?
Well, you know, I'm not 100% sure. So we're starting to enter into new territory. So Friday would mark the third week of the shutdown, and so that would begin to tie, I think. And then by Saturday, I guess we would have surpassed the 1995 shutdown as sort of having the longest shutdown in U.S. history. So thinking back to the shutdown that happened during the Clinton administration with the showdown between Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich. Once we start to move into something that could be seriously long-term, which, you know, is unprecedented in U.S. history, then there may be some people who, you know, do decide to try to seek out alternative forms of employment. You know, what the stories that I've heard suggest that what people are hunkering down and doing is applying for unemployment insurance. And then also, using other methods, relying on friends and family, using crowdfunding sources like GoFundMe to try to stop this temporarily. So, you know, if this ends up being a relatively temporary shutdown, I'm not quite sure how many people would actually take that option to go into the private sector. But if this does drag on for weeks and months, then, I would not be surprised if people decided to exercise that particular option and just decide that they're going to seek more stable work in the private sector.
We're talking with Andra Gillespie. She is an associate professor of political science at Emory University, looking at the 18th day of the partial government shutdown. And you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Where are you seeing the effects of the federal shutdown? Are you a government worker? What should people know about your situation? How are you managing this shutdown personally? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Andra, most staff at national parks are not deemed essential, so they're not working, but many parks are still open, and we've seen reports of people who have died in accidents or falls at national parks during this shutdown. What happens when the government is shut down and the parks stay open?
This is something that I'm less familiar with. And so usually, I'm used to seeing parks and things shut down completely during shutdowns. And so basically, sort of what's happened is that people are allowed to enjoy parks at their own risk. And so what we've seen is that they're, with fewer staff in the park service, there to monitor things. You know, there have been stories about, people abusing the facilities, so off-roading, for instance, in places where if there were park rangers, for instance, we would have seen people sort of being there to be able to stop that type of behavior. I don't know sort of what the liability issues are as a result of that. A lawyer could probably better answer that question, but, I don't know if somebody would then subsequently come in and try to sue the federal government for saying, look, this accident happened, on your property, and so therefore you might incur some liability as a result of being there. One of the things that was really interesting was that, at the start of the shutdown, I think part of the reason why things haven't shut down completely might have been to give the impression that the shutdown was being done in a way that was going to at least try to have some surgical precision in terms of the impact on the American public. And unfortunately, when you hear about stories of trash piling up in certain places, which would actually be hard in Washington, D.C., for instance, because how are you going to keep people from walking on the National Mall? Or you hear of people having accidents and unfortunately losing their lives in parks. But I think, part of the motivation behind that was to try to say that they were trying to minimize the impact of what everyday Americans would feel.
So we see the shutdown consequences impacting everything from parks to airports, federal buildings. But who does this partial government shutdown really hurt?
Well, it hurts the workers the most because they're the ones whose livelihoods are being impacted by this. The inconvenience, it's more than just an inconvenience to not get a paycheck, especially when bills are due, because, creditors are not necessarily guaranteed to show leniency. They're not necessarily, going to be predisposed to waive, interest fees and other things that people incur when they can't pay their bills on time. But I think we should realize that this affects all of us. So aside from the, sort of optics of shutting down the government in ways that doesn't necessarily make us look the most efficient, we forget the ways that government impacts our lives and that there are functions that the government does that nobody else can do that aren't going to be replicated always in the private sector, that aren't going to be replicated in the nonprofit sector, and that have bearing on our lives. So, whether it is making sure that, we can board our flights safely, or whether it is making sure that we have access to capital to start businesses, or whether it is making sure that we have, people who can answer questions.
And I'm going to have to pause you right there. We'll pick up the conversation here on the partial government shutdown in just a moment on the Ideas Network. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers remain furloughed in the partial government shutdown. Democrats took control of the House last week and passed legislation that would fund the federal agencies impacted. But President Trump has remained steadfast. Any measures that don't meet his demand for border wall funding are a no-go. We're looking at the ripple effect on government workers and agencies here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Political analyst Andra Gillespie is our guide. She's an associate professor of political science at Emory University. And your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Are you a transportation security officer? What's it like to work without pay? Did you hop on a plane this weekend? What did you hear or what did you say to TSA agents doing their jobs without a paycheck? Perhaps you received SNAP benefits. Are you concerned that the Agriculture Department will run out of money for those benefits? You can call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go right to the phones now with Mark joining us from New Berlin. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, I'll tell you what, I'm really fed up with this. Last two shutdowns, I was at national parks, and both times we were not allowed in the park at all. I wanted to use hiking trails. I wasn't allowed to use hiking trails at all, so they weren't open the last couple of times. And in fact, in Washington, veterans were walled off from the the Vietnam veteran thing and everything. A wall is good enough to keep veterans out, but not illegals. Anyway, I think this is all about the hate for Trump that the Democrats have. This is 0.1% of the federal budget. Build the dang wall, and let's get moving.
Mark, thanks for the call. Andra, what is the politics at stake here? Is this about not being able to work across the aisle?
Well, I mean, I think people are still at cross pressures and they're still not talking to each other. So, President Trump's offer to compromise has been to, not talk about a concrete wall anymore, but to talk about a steel slat wall. But we still haven't gotten to the point that we're talking about a comprehensive border security plan. So I think everybody is agreed that, the United States has a responsibility to protect its borders. But it's a question of whether or not the wall is the most effective way. And so there are a lot of people who think that just building a wall for a wall's sake is not actually the most effective way to truly protect the borders. That wall might be a nice optic for some people, or it could be a threatening optic for other people. But if we are actually trying to make sure that we're doing the things that President Trump says that he wants to do, so for instance, making sure that drugs don't cross the border, there are other ways, because more drugs actually, come in through ports than they do come across that border. Even if you build a wall, there could be tunnels. There are elaborate tunnel systems that people are already aware of. So if you're going to have a true border security plan, it has to be multifaceted, and it has to involve just more than erecting a wall. We're not having that conversation yet. Until we have that conversation, we're going to be really hard-pressed, one, to truly have border security, but it's going to be really hard to solve this particular impasse right now.
Meanwhile, the president is having this primetime address tonight about what he calls the humanitarian and national security crisis on our southern border. He'll visit the border Thursday. What is your take on this strategy and its timing?
Well, the big question is whether or not President Trump is going to try to use his ability to declare a national emergency so that he can reappropriate funds unilaterally to try to build the wall. And that actually has the potential to raise a constitutional crisis, and you might see Congress kind of push back on that. It's Congress's responsibility to decide how money is spent, so the people have the power of the purse. The president isn't supposed to take this authority except in extreme situations. And so there are, times where there are national emergencies, like genuine national emergencies, where it may require that, hey, we budgeted for this, but look, this crisis has come up. And so now we've got this exogenous shock that's going to require us to sort of rethink, to tweak the budget a little bit to allow for certain types of things. So tonight what we want to see, and I don't know what's going to happen yet, is if President Trump is going to try to make the case that the border crisis constitutes a national emergency, which would allow him to reallocate funds that have already been budgeted to make sure that the wall gets built. And so it'll be curious to see whether or not he does that. whether or not he makes the case that this is a national emergency, and then to see how Congress responds to that and whether or not they actually end up trying to take strong steps, which, you know, they typically don't take, but, you know, challenging him politically or even perhaps trying to get it enjoined, you know, in a court.
Let's go back to the phones now with Gary joining us from Merrill. Good morning, Gary.
Yes, good morning. I don't hear much from the people that I know of too much concern about the federal employees. They have the same remedy that the rest of us have in the private sector. They can file for unemployment, and then when they get their payback from the federal government, they pay back their unemployment benefits. So they and the essential employees, when they are hired, they sign an agreement that if they're not getting paid, they have to come to work anyway, unless they quit. So I'm all in favor of the shutdown, and we hired the president that he would secure those borders, and I don't think they should open up the government until he gets his wall.
Gary, thanks so much for the call. Andra, as we look at the news reports coming out, and especially TSA officials, you know, who had said they had called in sick, CNN, the president kind of tweeted about that, and CNN is standing by its reporting during the shutdown that in large numbers. How can people watching the shutdown figure out what the facts are?
Well, I mean, I think that there are a number of things to think about. One, I think you need to triangulate your sources, and so you need to get your news from a wide variety of sources and look to see whether or not people are saying the same thing. So I would be suspicious of one news organization reporting something that none of the other organizations have picked up. When there seems to be sort of a consensus around certain types of facts happening, then you probably are on track to be able to identify something as being real. The other thing that I would do is that I would always question sources that have a reputation and a track record of making misleading statements. And then I would always ask sources, especially, you know, in press conferences, and you're seeing some reporters starting to do this, to ask people to verify their sources or identify the source of their information so that you can independently verify what's going on. The other thing, you know, that I would talk about here is that if somebody says something and throws out an outrageous fact or figure, then think about that and don't believe it until you've had a chance to do your own research and actually be able to explore it. The other thing that I think is actually really important in this day and age to keep in mind is that people throw out numbers, but they don't always define their terms. And so sometimes they will throw out a number, but it turns out that it's the wrong number from sort of like the wrong stratum or the wrong class of figures. So, you know, there is a lot of debate, for instance, about the number of people who have been detained trying to enter the U.S. from the South. And so it's a question of, okay, so where does that number come from? Who are these people, and what are they being detained for? You know, if people are being detained at the southern border because they come from countries that are on lists, but they themselves are not necessarily terrorists, is that the same thing as saying that there are a certain number of terrorists that have crossed the border? So, you know, it's just a question of making sure that you're always getting people to define their terms, and always making sure that, like, they're providing sources so that you can go back and verify it. And then I would argue that there's strength in numbers. So when you have more than one sort of source bearing witness to something, there's probably some truth there.
Andra, going back to the agencies impacted, we've entered tax season. What about tax returns? Is the IRS impacted by the shutdown?
So the IRS has been impacted by the shutdown, but there have been orders to, I guess, change the classification of some IRS employees. So the Treasury Department released a statement yesterday saying that they were actually calling back some Treasury employees so that they could process IRS checks. So I guess they have now been considered or being changed. Some of them are being changed to being considered essential employees so that they could do that government function. So, you know, in terms of sort of how we're defining who's essential and who's not essential, you know, I think is really important here. You know, if you're doing something that the government is deeming is really, really important, whether or not it's related to national security, like, you know, we're seeing some changes. on the side. And so, you know, I think people are trying to do this in a way so that the everyday American citizen is less affected by what's going on. But even if you personally aren't affected, somebody you know is, and somebody in your community is. And I would just encourage people to, you know, to be mindful of that. So even if people knew that this was, you know, part of the job of having a, you know, a federal gig, and it was what they signed up for, nobody wants the disruption of having, you know, to lose pay for a period of time, even if they get it back. I think we have to acknowledge and walk in our brothers and our sisters' shoes and understand what it's like to sort of have a person's income be disrupted and ask whether or not that's actually sort of appropriate and whether or not we should try to avoid doing that at all costs.
Andra, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta and a political analyst. She teaches courses on African-American politics, political participation, and race and elections. Up next, it's news. Then we talk about volunteering. What prompts us to pitch in when the trash piles up at the national park, or why we deliver meals to people who are homebound? We explore how volunteering differs by state and what that tells us about the people who live across America. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. New federal numbers on volunteering reveal that more Americans than ever are lending a hand in their community. The numbers for 2017 were recently released. Americans volunteered nearly 6.9 billion hours, worth an estimated $167 billion in economic value. We're putting this volunteerism under the microscope here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Michael Bell is a professor of community and environmental sociology at UW-Madison. His most recent book is called City of the Good: Nature, Religion, and the Ancient Search for What is Right. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you so much. It's a delight to be here. In this early morning hour, right.
Well, so this new data from the Corporation for National and Community Service placed Milwaukee at number four.
Yay, Milwaukee, with
the highest rate of volunteerism in its recent report, showing that about 45% of people in the Milwaukee area volunteered. What do we know about the forces that drive people to volunteer?
Well, it's really a very positive, wonderful thing. You know, it's so often I think we dwell on really negative things in the news. Isn't it great to hear something positive? Yes, people are helping each other out. And really, one of the reasons for that, maybe the biggest reason, is that, believe it or not, people actually care about each other.
Breaking news. So people care about each other, and then connect that, though, to volunteerism. Where is that connection?
Yeah, so I think so often we are encouraged to think that what we are supposed to do is go out and, you know, win this hyper-competitive society that we're in. Oh, Clemson beat Alabama this year, and Alabama beat Clemson last year, and go, go, go. Yeah, who's going to win? Who's going to win? Who's going to win? But really, that's a very small part of what makes the human. And also, part of what holds a human together is the communities that they're in, and that volunteering, that care for other part, is so crucial to that. If you really want to meet a sad person, I don't know why you would, but it's probably a person whose community is weak or has been shattered in some way.
What makes an area of people more likely than another community to have more volunteerism?
So we did a study a few years ago of 99 counties in Iowa. It was all 99 counties in Iowa, looking at exactly that question. And what we found is that in communities where people report that they like each other more, they do more volunteering. And again, breaking news, right? But it actually, given that we're so often told that life is about competition and winning and the market and sports, and we turn everything into a competition, isn't it nice to know that it actually turns out that people do care about each other, and when they do, they volunteer more.
So, Michael Bell, I'm curious, how do you define volunteerism? Is it, you know, simply free labor, or is there something deeper there?
Well, so the study that you mentioned had a fairly narrow definition of it. They're really looking at things that people do not explicitly for money. And, of course, that is certainly a measure.
But perhaps baseline measure.
Baseline measure, yeah. But then think of what goes on in any workplace as well, right? I mean, even here at the studio, I mean, there's things that need to get done. But, you know, you're not necessarily going to get directly rewarded for doing it. And if you notice that there are some kind of nice people who consistently step up and do those things. So it's very broad throughout society. There is just showing up for work, punching the clock, stepping out. I don't do anything more than that. But then even within those places, even within a family, right? Who is going to clean the cat box? Who's going to feed the chickens? I fed the chickens this morning. Yay. Okay. But, you know, these are little volunteer tasks. And one does them because one is in a situation where there's this very important interaction taking place in the relationship. I don't know if I can go on just a little bit about
ahead.
This. Okay, so let's imagine a very short-run social exchange relationship. Say you want to buy some lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the store. You pick up your lettuce. You go to the cash register. Right. You give them some money, they let you take the lettuce, and that's the end of it. Okay, maybe you smiled nicely, I hope you did, at the checker, but maybe you even used the automatic thing.
Yeah,
on there, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's like not any social or very, very minimal social relationship involved there. And that's in part because, okay, well, I mean, you can get lettuce in a lot of different places, and, you know, there's not necessarily a continuous relationship that you're expecting with that cashier.
After all, it's a quick exchange, and there's a whole, you know, bigger life out there to lead.
Exactly. But now let's imagine that you and I are going to engage in something that we consider a more long-term relationship. So you scratch my back, I scratch yours. But in reality, in most cases, when you and I are exchanging back scratching, it actually isn't in the same time. Usually there's a delay involved. Like, okay, say you and I we're a couple and we're going to go to try to advance each other's career, and you sacrifice so I can go to graduate school, and then you expect that I'm going to sacrifice so you can do whatever's right for your career, right? So there's an exchange there that takes place across time. Well, how do I know that you're going to come through, and how do you know that I'm going to come through? But because you think that the relationship is based on something else. Otherwise, you know, you might abandon me for somebody richer, more beautiful, nicer, whatever the heck it is, okay?
You're putting volunteerism on a much bigger scale here.
Well, absolutely, because it's recognizing that what our relationships are based upon is not simply an exchange of interests, but to have that exchange of interests, you need to have a sense of trust. And that coming from the sense of sentiments, which is, I actually care about you, you care about me. And you can't get that exchange of interest unless you have that trust, and that trust only comes there because you think the relationship is founded on something more than interest.
Michael Bell is with us. He's a professor of community and environmental sociology at UW-Madison. We're looking at the intricacies of volunteerism, why we do it, who does it. Your thoughts are welcome. 800-642-1234. How do you volunteer? Do you think people should volunteer, and why? And how do you think we could benefit from a life of servitude? What area do you see shortages of volunteers, and who could benefit the most? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Michael, as you look at this data from the Corporation for National and Community Service, we can see that states with some of the lowest rates of volunteerism are also the ones where the median incomes are pretty low. I mean, I could just look at it point blank, and you saw Mississippi and Alabama and New Mexico and Louisiana, very low rates of volunteerism. So how does socioeconomic status play into the likelihood that a person will volunteer?
Well, so when your economic situation is not good, you tend to think that that solidarity of interests of my participating in my community life isn't really working out very well. And why is that not working out well? Well, maybe because those folks don't care about me, right? So in situations when our interests don't come together, then we have a sense that we don't have the sentiments there. So it's an interaction there, a solidarity of interests, like having a decent income, is dependent upon a solidarity of sentiments. And conversely, if you don't come through in my interests, I'm going to think you don't like me very much, right? So the two interact. And if you start breaking something with that highly competitive market approach and also the inequalities involved there, not surprisingly, people won't feel that kind of engagement and love of place. So when we did that study in Iowa, what we found is that place attachment, the sense of I love my community, and we had measures of that in the survey, was super, super important in predicting whether people would engage and volunteer.
Let's bring in religion to the conversation. How much of a bearing does one's religion have on their likelihood of volunteering?
Yeah, well, so an enormous amount of the volunteering in the United States takes place through churches. And other forms of temples and mosques and other places of worship. And that's one of the places that we're really quite distinctive from Europe. Volunteering rates in the U.S. in general are about twice what they are in Europe. And a lot of that is because religious participation is much higher here. But generally speaking, one doesn't go to church just because you're hoping to advance your job. No, maybe people are making some business connections and things there, but that's not what it's supposed to be about.
But do you see religious institutions, churches, an avenue into volunteerism, a way to be able to do it effectively?
It can be very effective. And one of the things that troubles me sometimes about the way we do volunteering is that so often we turn it into a competition. So, for example, all of those college applications that say, oh, have you done your 50 hours of community service? Or this award, did you do 75 hours? And, okay, I'm doing it because I'm trying to advance my career. And that's certainly not helpful. It's really kind of going against the very spirit of it. And it's
the whole ethic of volunteerism.
The ethic is going to end as soon as the 50 hours are up and the person's in college.
Michael Bell is our guide as we look at the intricacies of volunteerism. He's a professor of community and environmental sociology at UW-Madison. Gathering your thoughts on volunteerism, 800-642-1234. Has volunteerism always been a big part of your life? Did your parents get you started at a young age and you've kept it up? What do you get out of volunteering, and where do you see a shortage of volunteers? Let's talk about it. Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We are looking at trend lines in volunteerism here on The Morning Show. According to a 2018 Volunteering in America report, more than 77 million volunteers across the country contributed nearly 7 billion hours in 2017. Looking at what that means. Michael Bell pays close attention to this. He's a professor of community and environmental sociology at UW-Madison. Gathering your thoughts, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. How do you define volunteerism? Could we consider it to be something as small as shoveling a neighbor's driveway in the winter? Do you think more people should volunteer and why, and how do you think we could all benefit from a life of volunteering? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, I want to pick your brain a little bit about national emergencies like 9/11, like Hurricane Katrina. You remember the images of people stepping up, of helping in a myriad ways, volunteering their time, giving blood. Do these types of disasters affect the way people feel about volunteering, and how long does it last?
Well, there's a really interesting finding that sociologists have seen in situations where communities have experienced disasters, which is that social well-being initially goes down as people are dealing with the disaster, but 6 months or so afterwards, their general feelings typically for their fellow human beings goes up.
Why is that?
Yeah, it's odd because you think, I mean, I'm not going to wish a disaster on anybody, but what usually happens in when there's a good response, like there's a national reach out to the situation, is that people discover that others actually do care for them. Initially, social ties get frayed because of all the, you know, the damage and trauma, of course. But the people who put you up for the night, the folks who sent food packages, the people who drove all night to come and help cut down trees that have fallen across roads, those things are so powerfully meaningful, and particularly in a society which is so competitively oriented. It's just a wonderful experience to say, actually, I am cared for.
So we don't realize that those support systems are there until we really need them? And then that carries over into how we feel about community?
I think that's part of it. I think also because we're encouraged to think that our possessions, which is a highly competitive thing, is what's so important. How big is my house? All the stuff that's inside it. I remember some years ago, I was on a late night flight back from California. And I wound up sitting in the back with the flight attendant. It was mostly an empty flight. And she started telling the story of how her home had burned to the ground about 6 months previously. And I said, that's just awful. It was a terrible thing to have imagine if you went home today
Everything
and your house
gone.
Had burned down. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean, just it would just be so devastating. And she said, no, it's the best thing that ever happened to me. Because everyone reached out to me. All these people I hadn't heard from in years reached out to me. So, yes, I think it can be these national disasters are part of what reminds us that we really are a community.
Martin Luther King Jr. Day is coming up January 21st, and people may or may not know that this is really intended to be a day of service, a day on, not off, as they say, but many people typically treat it as a regular day off. What does that say to you, if anything, about how Americans spend their time on that particular day?
Well, I think, again, it's just reaching out to others is so important for bringing a community together, but it is also good for yourself too. Not only did, for example, with the story of that flight attendant, she had the experience of she is cared for, but when you have the experience of caring for someone else, it's also very powerful and good for you.
Jennifer in Fort Atkinson sent an email and said, can you talk about the rates of volunteering and the differences between genders? Do we see a gender difference in who is volunteering?
Yes, we do. Women volunteer significantly more than men do. And we also see differences in stage of the family life cycle. Parents typically volunteer more, and that's shown in that survey. Right now, the Gen Xers have more kids than anybody else, and their participation rates are higher. But I think that sort of competitive orientation is so much part of how we raise men that they don't seem to put as much time in the community. Frankly, they don't put as much time in at home either.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Karen now, joining us from Middleton. Karen, hi.
Good morning. I just turned your show on 2 minutes ago. My question is, my husband and I are both involved with several environmental groups, and there's intellectual and physical work involved. People have work crews that go out and do land restoration, and then there's projects and things. I'm sure this is not unique, but the groups are aging out. People are getting to be quite elderly, and physical work can be a little bit more challenging, but even just people in leadership roles. And I didn't know if you had any resources you recommended, any books or ideas for how to rejuvenate organizations like that.
Great question, Karen. Thank you for that.
Yeah, so Karen, advice I would give would be to try to find ways to get young people in leadership positions in the organization. Sometimes we expect young people to show up and pitch in, but the young people typically want to feel that they are helping lead the organization. And often when you get an older organization, the older folks think, well, we know how this thing runs. And so there's a little bit of a trouble sometimes in giving up the reins.
And are we losing a large number of baby boomers in volunteering ranks? Are you seeing that? Because certainly in retirement, that's a great time to volunteer. But then, you know, you get to a certain point, as Karen says, and you're going to have to pull back some.
Well, yes, for sure. As baby boomers who are retired are able to put in, you know, more time because they're not at work, but also, as Karen was describing, maybe they don't have the same physical capacity that they might have earlier, and that's certainly a serious challenge.
How can we foster a desire to give back in our communities? What would be your selling point here? I'm even afraid to ask the question because this is going to be robust. I sense it.
Well, I do think that the programs that expect young people to volunteer because it's going to be good on their college application, that is not a good approach. I think it's much more important to get people involved in ways that they're seeing that they are building community from it. One of the problems that Karen might have experienced in her organization is that we do have very strong gender barriers in a sense of community. Young people kind of like to hang out with young people. Older people kind of like to hang out more with older people, although they also like to hang out with young people. I think maybe they're more open across the way there. But it's so important to understand that what we're doing is not just volunteering, but we're building community.
Michael Bell, thank you so much for coming in. This has been such a pleasure.
I thank you so much. I had a great time.
Michael Bell is a professor of community and environmental sociology at UW-Madison. His most recent book out last year is called City of the Good: Nature, Religion, and the Ancient Search for What is Right. Just ahead, though it got its start around 1900, the amateur radio operator community is more vibrant than ever, and we're going to learn what makes them tick with a look at ham radio operation here in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.